I'd like to invite our next two speakers up. Let me get you your presentations. Does that look right?
That's it.
Okay. So let's welcome Nicholas Daffron and Matthew Wiley from Chicago, University of Chicago and Northwestern. University, did I get that correct?
We'll correct it.
You'll correct it, okay. And they will even read you their title.
Well, thanks for being here. The title of our presentation is Adam, Darwin, and the Rest of Us, Assessing the Doctrine of Original Sin in Light of the Theory of Evolution. So first, just by way of introduction, my name is Matt Wiley. I'm a PhD student in systematic theology. Coincidentally, my project is on the theological interpretation of Scripture. This one, not so much, but I'm at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, just up the road in Deerfield. I'm also the managing editor at the Henry Center for Theological Understanding there. You might have seen our booth out there. We're currently running the Creation Project, and that's my main entryway into some of these science theology conversations. I'm joined this afternoon by Nick Daffron. He's a PhD student in biophysics at Northwestern University. Nick and I go to church together, and this is kind of the way that this project came about for us. Is we really believe that the church is the best host for these sort of interdisciplinary conversations. We found that we were both thinking through these things and thought that it would be good to work through them publicly and to think about them and then to come to ASA. Now, with that, we did just propose to give a little poster and have more conversations, and then ASA reached out to us and asked that we would do a presentation. So we're a little surprised. We're happy to do it, but our aims remain modest. We really do believe that this is best just a conversation starter. We're both, as our pink ribbons indicate, first-time attendees here, so we're very aware that many of you are much more familiar with these conversations than we are, so we look forward, hopefully, to a good time of Q&A. We'll try to get through it quick enough that we have that. So our hope for this presentation is to sort of set the table for the current issues surrounding the doctrine of original sin, in particular, in light of the theory of evolution. Just want to reiterate that our main aim is to dialogue with you after. We're not going to have any sort of grand synthesis. This is the way forward. No such attempt. So just an outline of what's coming. I will mainly just be doing some table setting as a theologian, so I'll give a very brief history of the doctrine of original sin. What is it? What are the contemporary challenges to it? Different approaches in terms of how do we link ourselves to Adam and how is Adam's sin? How does that implicate us? And then I will pose, as a theologian, three questions to Nick as a scientist. He will then take over, answer my questions, and give some scientific evidence. At the end, we'll do some brief sort of gathering, restating, and then highlighting what we think are future areas, future conversations that need to happen. And then we will turn it over to the good part and let you guys contribute and ask questions and help us move forward. So first, a brief overview of original sin. G.K. Chesterton says, original sin is the only part of Christian theology which can really be proved. And anyone who has raised a toddler agrees. And yet, at the same time, it is a doctrine that has been challenged in light of modern scientific findings, particularly around historical Adam, field of genetics, all these sorts of things. It is a challenged doctrine by many accounts. In terms of what the doctrine is, it's a twofold doctrine. So it's an account of our own sinfulness. How is it that we are born sinful, right? And at the same time, it's also an account of the origin of sin generally. So it, on the one hand, links us to Adam in one way. And on the other hand, it also preserves the goodness of creation as it indicates that God did not create sin, but that there was an original sin, right? An original event that was sinful and the introduction of evil. So that's generally what the doctrine does, its function in theology. The current issues and challenges as we see it and as we've kind of approached the topic surround these three areas. One, the question of a historical Adam. Two, the eventfulness of the fall, right? In terms of preserving God's goodness and the goodness of creation, and yet at the same time hard to determine scientifically what changed at some sort of event of the fall of Adam. And then thirdly, the spread of death. So if Adam and Eve are in the garden as some sort of representatives, and yet it seems like there's already a lot of death happening, What is it about the fall that's unique, and how does that death spread to all men, as Romans 5 indicates? Just briefly, again, here are some different accounts of original sin. A book that was just published last month, actually, by Tom McCall on the doctrine of sin has a very, very good account of these different ways of interpreting original sin. And so I'll just briefly highlight them just to show that there are different ways that people give an account of our relationship to Adam. So the first is in sort of modern theologians like Schleiermacher or Tillich, and this is a sort of merely symbolic approach to Adam and our relationship to him. It's a more existential approach. Some might put Barth here with his sort of saga thing. I don't know about Bonhoeffer. I'm not sure what you would say to that. But this is the first way of thinking about our relationship to Adam is it's more, the story is a sort of myth that functions to tell us about how we are sinful. It's a sort of story that we can relate to. Next is a corruption-only view. So the doctrine of original sin has, we inherit something from Adam. Is it corruption and guilt or just corruption? So that's the first question that a lot of people have to answer is, do we just inherit corruption from Adam, or are we also guilty on account of Adam? So the corruption-only view that we don't inherit any guilt from Adam, but just our sort of corrupted natures. That'd be Arminius. More recently, Stanley Grenz would probably be in this camp. This is that we are not guilty in any way because of what Adam did, but we are corrupted by it. Now, there is also a strong case to be made that we inherit not only corruption, but also guilt. And then if you believe that, there's a second question you have to answer, and that is, by what is Adam's guilt accredited to us? So the first view is federalism. This would be Francis Turretin or Wesley. This is the predominantly broadly understood reformed view, is Adam is our federal sort of representative head as whom God chose to be the representative of humanity. And so as he fell, because he was our representative, his guilt is imputed to us, right, in some way that he was our representative. The other option here is what's called a realist view, and that is that in some sense we were really in Adam. So seminally, we can trace our seed all the way back to the event of the fall. So we were there, and because we were there really, in some sense, we are guilty, right? So this would be Augustine or Jonathan Edwards. This is the realist view that we are corrupt and guilty because we were really in Adam, not just as a representative way, but seminally there. There are some mediate views when it comes to corruption and guilt, primarily because people are concerned about moral culpability. How can we be guilty for something that we did not do? So the mediate views, arguably Anselm and Calvin, although a lot of people associate Calvin with the federalist view, would be that we inherit our corruption from Adam, and we are guilty not because of Adam's corruption, but we become guilty because of our own corruption. So it still gets corruption and guilt, but the guilt is associated with our personal corruption, not with Adam's sin. So again, this is a very brief overview. I'm happy to answer more questions. Again, I'll just point you to this book if you want to read more on that issue. With that, I'm going to quickly turn to three questions as a theologian that I'm posing to a scientist, and then I'll hand it over to Nick until the end. The first question is, what can science teach us about a historical Adam? The second is, what can science teach us about how we are related to Adam? And the third is, what can science teach us about what changed at the event of the fall? So now I'll hand it over to Nick, and again, we look forward to the Q&A afterwards.
All right, thank you, Matt. Yeah, so these are the three questions that Matt has posed to me as a scientist. And so as a scientist, I'm going to do my best to answer these. So I'm going to start with just kind of a summary of what, as a scientist, I feel like some of the answers are, what science can touch upon. And then I'll dive more into the specific evidence that I think supports these answers. So for the question of what can science tell us about Adam, I actually don't think that science can tell us a whole lot about Adam, specifically because I think it's very possible that God could have picked any two people out of a population, decided these are Adam, or he could have, de novo created Adam. I think the key here is the question of how are we related to an Adam. So in that way, I think science has a lot to say. Specifically, I think that it says that it's definitely possible that we're in some way related to Adam, but not it's not possible that we are solely derived from Adam. And then addressing the third question of, you know, what happened in as humans acquired God's image and then fell from grace, I think science definitely can't touch all of that question, but what it can say is that, at least in a physiological sense, there was not a quick change. The change was gradual. So let's go ahead and dive into the evidence. So I'll start with the last question first, because most of what science has to say on this issue revolves around evolution. And so addressing, you know, the idea of a gradual physiological change is the addressing the idea of evolution as a whole, and so that's a good place to start. So there's a lot of evidence for evolution, but I'm going to kind of cherry pick some of my favorite arguments here. One is vestigial traits. So these are traits that serve no function in humans or in other creatures, but they're similar to other traits in related species or in our ancestors where they did in fact serve a function. And so one interesting example of this is wisdom teeth. So in most people, there's no point to have these wisdom teeth, and in fact, they can be harmful. There's a number of other vestigial traits which are interesting, the tailbone, the appendix, some muscles in our ear that we are no longer able to use. For more direct evidence, you can look to the fossil record. So, like I said, there's a science says that physiologically we slowly changed over time, and the fossil record corroborates this in multiple parts of our physiology, but I think one of the most interesting ones is in human brain size. So over the last several million years, you can see actually an average increase in the brain size of hominin species. And actually, interestingly, this actually correlates very well with the complexity of the tools these species were using. Then for me, as someone who does a lot of molecular biology, probably the most convincing evidence are pseudogenes. So these are genes that are in our genome, but that because of mutations or deletions, they are no longer functional. However, these genes are very similar to functional genes in other species, so a sort of vestigial gene, if you will. One especially interesting analysis that you can do is look at olfactory genes in humans. So the largest group of genes in mammals are olfactory genes. And if you look, and 60% of these genes in humans are no longer functional. And then if you look in our closely related species, they also have some of these non-functional genes. And you look at the exact mutations or deletions that cause these genes to no longer function, they're the same mutations. And the closer the species is, evolution says the species is to related to us, the more similar pseudogenes they have. All right, so that's the question of you know, what was that change that occurred as we took on the image of God? And we say, physiologically, it was a slow change. But then, all right, the question is, did we descend from Adam? And so the answer, like I said, we descended from a population and not from two sole progenitors. And so the evidence here is mostly genetic. So the first, the most kind of important piece of evidence is the variety or the differences in our genome. So we can look specifically at these single nucleotide polymorphisms. These are specific places in the genome that are the same place in each of our genomes where we had differences. And so these are come about through mutations, and they come about at a specific rate. And so we can determine that if we came from a set population of a certain size, we would assume so many differences to occur as we multiply over a certain period of time. And so a lot of people have done these analyses, and it's actually known that there was a population bottleneck. It's been shown kind of early in our history. And they usually come up with an estimate of that bottleneck being a population in the thousands, but definitely not of two single people. That's just too little genetic variation that would come from that. And then an orthogonal technique that corroborates this is looking at linkage disequilibrium. So this is kind of based on the idea that when we pass on our chromosomes to a progeny, there's crossing over of certain regions of the chromosome. And actually, how far apart two genes are from each other affects how likely it is that they'll be swapped in their position. So what you can do is look at two genes that are very close to each other and are not likely to be swapped. And then from that, and then you can look at different sets of genes throughout our population and then look back at a certain time and see how diverse the set of those genes was for that population. And when they do this analysis, they come up with numbers for a population bottleneck that's similar to the analysis previously in the thousands range. All right, so that's the idea that we cannot be derived from two people solely. But I think science does say that it's possible that we are, and likely that we have a common ancestor in our past, that all humans have one common ancestor. And the idea here is that if you look at genealogical and not genetic relatedness, that it's much easier for those kind of relatedness to arise. That in a population, genealogical relatedness can arise very quickly. And kind of a parallel thing that's looked at in science that can kind of inform this is the idea of a Y chromosome atom and a mitochondrial Eve. And this is the idea that we all could have received our Y chromosomes from a single male and our mitochondrial genome from a single female. And so they can actually, a lot of people have studied this and tried to find our most recent common ancestors. So for example, here in this paper, they looked at this and estimated that our most recent common ancestor lived about roughly 100,000 years ago. All right, so where does that leave us? That leaves us with a theologian and a scientist with two sets of ideas that we're going to bring to the table. The theologian wanting to have the fact that Adam was a historical person and that we're related to him in some way, and that God created the world good and evil originated at the event of the fall, and that the image of God is essential to humanity and that human death is a result of the sin. And then as the scientist, I want to bring to the table that there could have been a historical Adam, but that we are, we could be related to Adam, but that we're not solely derived from Adam. And that when we're thinking about our creation in the image of God and what it means for death and sin to come about, that at least physiologically, that's not something that occurred rapidly. So then where do we go from there? So we wanted to just put forth a set of questions that we thought would be interesting for us to think about and that we've been kind of wrestling with and that we haven't come up with good answers for, but we think are important questions to think about. One is to define what it means to be human. So you can imagine you could have a theological definition and a biological definition, and so should we distinguish between these definitions, and if so, what are the differences? And then we want to determine how did that transition to human occur. And so this is very connected to the idea, like, what do we think it means to be human? And then if we have a population surrounding, an Adam and Eve, how then does this humanness get translated to the rest of the population? And then thinking beyond just our own humanity, but to the world in general, what are the results of the fall? And because evolution tells us that death has been around, physical death has been around for a long time. And so we want to know what is unique about human death. And then, like I said, kind of articulating the spread of our humanity from Adam to the rest of the population. So just to end here, I wanted to kind of, I think the discussions we've been having, the topics we're talking about are really, really important, but just as important is how we go about them. As we've been talking, we realized that an important thing for us to think about as we've been discussing this is what are the sticking points for us in our various fields, and then what are the gray areas, and in what ways can we accommodate the ideas of the other person and where they're coming from. And so just kind of understanding that as we come to the table in conversation, I think, is important. And then finally, critiquing correctly. Actually, as a scientist, it was interesting for me. I was helping my professor review a paper the other day, and I sent in my comments, and at the end of it, I wrote a little message like, sorry if these critiques are too harsh, tell me if you I need to like back off, and his reply to me was, no, that's exactly what this process is. That's what we do as scientists, is we critique each other and we better our ideas. And so that kind of struck me as, here at ASA, it's a lot of scientists and community of scientists, and that's what we do. And so I think it's really cool that we can take that technique and that thing that we do really well and apply it to these particular ideas. So with that, we'll open it up for questions.
Thank you. I want to commend you, and this seems to be a topic of a lot of intense interest. You can see a lot of people here. So let's get going with some questions. Thanks for giving us time for that.
Yes, thank you for the talk. But if I understood you correctly, the theologian position was, you're asking a question of how can we be in some way related to Adam. Mm-hmm. My question is do you ask that question because you are taking a particular view of original sin that you laid out in the first, or do you think all the views have to, in some way, make us related to Adam?
So I think all the views, except maybe the first view, one, that it's merely symbolic, all the others that we inherit, either corruption or some sort of corruption and guilt, in some sense, it comes from Adam and his fall. The nature of that relationship between us and Adam differs, obviously, in a federalist view or a realist view, in terms of it's a sort of judicial representative or a seminal presence we are really in Adam. But all accounts of original sin are trying to implicate, like, what is our sinfulness? What does that have to do with Adam and the fall, the narrative of the fall? So it's linking those two in some sense. I think almost all doctrines of original sin are trying to give some account of it.
Janet? So thank you. I particularly appreciated how you started with theology and then asked how science could inform our understanding. Few questions, and I understand the limitations of 20 minutes, but when you talk about fall, you're making an assumption of an original perfection, so I think a lot of that's going to depend on how you define this original perfection, Eden, etc.
Yes.
And also, you have clearly, there's multiple different understandings and definitions of sin, and I think it's really important to distinguish between, actual sins or our innate tendency towards sin.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, thanks. I think that's a helpful point, and I do agree that we did, the 20 minutes was limiting, and I think the theological, what we're trying to give, what part of what original sin does is preserves that God is not the author of it, right? That God does not create us necessarily that we would sin, right? That there's it's sort of a free will defense, these sorts of questions. And I think that what's hard as a theologian coming into these conversations is the amount of death and such that we, in theology, talk about death as a result of the fall. Death is, right? And that dogmatically is true, and yet we look around and we see a lot of death before what we think in the terms of the timeline. And so we're trying to get towards that question, admitting that we're not quite there.
So it's been a while since I thought through this carefully, but you're using both genetic and genealogical. And if I'm remembering correctly, you can be actually descended from an individual, and I believe it's after 12 generations, 13 generations, somewhere in there, that you can still have absolutely none of their genomic material.
Correct.
So you're looking at two very different things. You could be directly that really is great, 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 great grandpa, and you have none of his genetic material. So can you speak into how you're sort of reconciling those two?
Well, yeah, so that's definitely accurate. You can lose the genetic information very quickly, so then you need an idea of something else that's being transmitted. There's not like a physical thing that you can point to, right, that's going to be transmitted. Yeah.
Yeah, so this, I'm sure many of you, I don't know, I think he gave it last year here at ASA. Josh Swamidas has this proposal about the genealogical Adam.
Perspectives.
Okay,
well.
Yeah, and his book is forthcoming, and he deals a lot more in depth with this. He sent us an advanced copy of the book, and we looked through it briefly. But there is. I think it's a helpful distinction for me as a non-scientist. I didn't know you could distinguish between genealogy and genetics, and making that distinction, I think, can be very helpful. There's still a lot of unanswered questions it raises, but it's a helpful lead to me.
George, you started with a quotation from Chesterton, and other people said the same thing. I think that's a very problematic statement. What we can see from common sense is everybody does bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
That's a different thing from saying everybody, or perhaps rather nobody, begins life with loving God with all your heart and all your soul and all your mind and all your strength. In other words, sin is fundamentally, first of all, about our relationship with God,
mm-hmm.
before it has to do with what we do in the world and with other people.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, Chesterton is known for his one-liners, and most of them can be challenged, so I concede the point in that regard.
So, isn't it about time that we start to dispense with the idea of original sin? Because it's kind of not helping us in a way that, over the years, science has been taught Christian theology. And so, it's not helpful, and maybe God is light, there's no darkness at all. Mm-hmm. But let's look at the whole walk, walk of history, not just one part, the start. Mm-hmm. And God's good intentions for fellowship, and Christ's life can be imparted to us, so we can actually attain to the divine life through Christ. Mm-hmm. And so, it takes a time, we'll get there. So maybe God is good, and sin is part of our innate behaviour because of our evolutionary sort of predisposition.
That's the challenge. I think that as a theologian, I'm uncomfortable with some scriptural, reconciling that with some of what scripture seems to me to teach, and more broadly, history of theology would... That's a strong claim, but perhaps.
I had an opportunity to have a discussion with Joshua, and was introduced to him. We had about an hour discussion on this. My question to him was, what would be the likelihood we could all have genetic material in some way from Adam, who lived about 7,000 years ago, and yet there's pockets of civilization who do not have Neanderthal DNA, and Neanderthals were over 30,000 years ago. If we don't have Neanderthal ancestry, and many people don't, then what would be the likelihood that we all could have some genetic material from Adam, and he couldn't answer that question?
I bring up Swamidas's idea of the genealogical relatedness. I definitely don't. I'm not presenting his timeline. And reading his timeline, I definitely was skeptical of that as well. And there's a lot of opportunities for that to be disproved as you think about population movements and stuff like that. And so that's why I referenced specifically why Adam and the mitochondrial Eve as kind of evidence of a genealogical relatedness. And so I don't think the genetic connection is there. Necessarily.
What do you make of the fact that Adam drops out of the Old Testament after the fifth chapter of Genesis, apart from a brief mention in the chronology at the beginning of First Chronicles, and that sin in the Old Testament, which is all over the place, seems not to be attributed to Adam or to the fall, but rather to the behavior of the people who are doing the sinning.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's been brought up. I think that's... John Collins has dealt with that question pretty well, I think. It is strange how... Well, I'm getting there. It is strange how absent Adam is. That is, at first, doctrinally strange because of how significant he is in theology. I think, canonically, the New Testament makes him pretty important again, particularly Paul, right? Romans 5 is equally scripture, and I don't think it's reading into the Old Testament to put it there. I think we have canonical warrant to make the link if we follow Paul.
As I understand it, C.S. Lewis and Greg Boyd advocate for some version of a cosmic fall for the explanation. Is that something that's still active in scholarship, or is that kind of curious?
So Lewis is always interesting in theological conversations because he's theological but not a theologian.
Sure.
And I have reservations about Boyd's project generally.
Sure.
Is it still out there? Yes. Boyd is very popular right now. I think that some sort of cosmic fall seems to me even harder to reconcile with things that we see in evolution because there doesn't seem to be a drastic change in the patterns. So... there's cosmic language in the New Testament in Colossians or other places, and I think that there's something going on there, but I don't think it's merely that.
Yeah. So I think the traditional view in Protestantism, and maybe even going back to Augustine, is that there were a number of physical changes in the creation and the fall.
Mm-hmm.
And people have said, things like the second law of thermodynamics and germs and diseases, and we've step back from a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see any biblical evidence for any physical changes at all at the fall?
Yeah. So, yeah, this is a question that was posed to me pretty directly in the spring when someone was showing evidence of cancer before the fall, right? And that, as a theologian, that seems problematic with some of the ways that we talk about such things. Is there evidence for some physical change? In Scripture, human death is a result of the fall. So that comes to the defining human question.
But could that just be being
spiritual?
Kicked out of the
sure, yeah.
Not being allowed to access the tree of life.
I think it's I there's a lot of proposals. Richard Middleton talks about human mortality before the fall. We weren't created immortal and we're never going to die. I think that has some traditional. I mean, Calvin is open to that. Bonhoeffer, I would say, is open. You know, so there's some warrant there. I'm comfortable with some sort of conditional mortality in Eden. At the same time, admitting it's speculation, what would have happened if Adam and Eve hadn't sinned? So, yeah.
Well, thank you very much for your.